Hi, I'm Philip Shepherd. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this amazing once-in-a-lifetime conference, and especially to the Meditation and Breathwork channel, which I'm proud to be sponsoring because meditation and breathwork are essential to my teachings. I'm the founder of the Embodied Present Process, or TEP, which is based on my two books and is taught worldwide. And here's one thing I believe about meditation and breathwork. You limit your experience of both if you imagine that your mind is just the thoughts in your head. Your mind permeates your every cell. Every stirring of energy within your body is an expression of it. So, if you wish to calm your mind, the most direct route is to develop the skills that enable you to feel the body's energy and ground it in the spaciousness of the present. That's what my work is about. If that appeals to you, I hope you'll check out my two presentations, one on this channel and one on the main stage. You might also be interested in a special offer exclusive to the Embodiment Conference to listen to one of my embodied meditations for yourself for free. You can find a link to the special offer in the description of this presentation or on the show notes. And now, enjoy the presentation.
Okay, everybody, welcome to the Embodiment Conference and the Meditation and Breathwork channel. And I'm very honored to be introducing Dr. Daniel Ingram. Daniel, I'll do a quick introduction of you, and then I'll pass the room to you. Dr. Daniel Ingram is a retired emergency medical physician and also trained as an epidemiologist. He's the author of the cult classic, Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha, an unusually hardcore Dharma book, as well as co-author of The Fire Casinas. He is a meditation teacher and practitioner with over 27 years experience. He has a particular interest in deep technical practice, deep exploration of the past, and adventuring in unusual meditation territories. He is a longtime student of the maps of meditation, advanced meditative phenomenology, and a range of possibilities that practice may bring. His primary focus these days is organizing researchers and other academics to study how to bring a functional awareness of the deep end of spiritual and meditative experience to the clinical mainstream. This project is called the Emergent Phenomenology Research Consortium. Today's session is titled Skillfully Navigating the Dark Night, a focus on strategies that can help when dealing with spiritual crisis, emergencies, and difficulties in ourselves and others. Daniel, the room is yours.
All right. Welcome, everybody. So I would like to start with a disclaimer. This is not a substitute for medical advice. This is not a substitute for getting good local care if you need it. This is not a substitute for a good medical exam or a good therapist or any of those things. If you're having serious trouble, which some of you might be if you're watching a talk like this, then it's important to know that if you really need help, get it, because there is help out there. We'll talk a little bit about how to access that, but that's an important thing to just start with. The second thing is to say, what in the world is the dark night? So we're going to talk about a little basic map theory. For some people, they would define it as just a hard time. You know, the word gets used somewhat loosely in various contexts, and that can be fine. But from more sort of a technical mappy point of view, I am generally meaning a set of experiences that from a sort of point of view, often come after what's called a peak experience. So a peak experience will happen. There will be what we might call an arising and passing away, or a peak moment, or a conversion experience, or a breakthrough experience. Lots of different words for this kind of thing. It can involve powerful Kundalini stuff, rapture, profound religious or spiritual zeal, a lot of usually very positive factors, though not always. It can actually be relatively mild. It can occur in dreams. It can occur on psychedelics. It can occur on intensive retreats. It can occur during childbirth. It can occur during ordinary circumstances of life for no obvious reason. It can sometimes occur when people are relatively young, even without meditative training. And other people can go on tons of retreats and stuff and never get into this territory. So The theory would say, and some practical experience also shows, that once one crosses something called the arising and passing away, as I'm going to call it, or I might just use shorthand called the A&P, which you can think peak experience, breakthrough, whatever, something sort of dark nighty is theorized to follow, and that often happens in practice. Now, first of all, the arising and passing away event can literally be seconds or minutes. It may not always be dramatic, and the dark night need not be dramatic either. So other names for the dark night include the knowledges of suffering, the dukkha jnanas, the underworld of the hero's journey. There are lots of various names for this thing. Sufi traditions refer to things like nafs, and you'll get like lung and qi disorders when you talk about like Taoism or Tibetan practices. Anyway, so that's sort of an overview of what this is. And the nice thing is that after it, from a Theravadini map theory point of view, comes something, a stage called equanimity. And equanimity is sort of this open, expansive, spacious stage that is really nice. So the important thing to know here is that the path is not linear for the vast majority of people. You go up, you go down, you come to some sort of plateau that's some kind of better, and you may cycle around and around and around that. So that's a little bit of basic stage theory, so you'll understand some of the terms I'm going to use. Formally, from a Theravadini old school map point of view, and this stuff comes out of the Visuddhimagga and Vimuttimagga, the technical names of these stages would be: the arising and passing away leads to dissolution, fear, misery, disgust, desire for deliverance, something called reobservation, which is often a real sort of contracted, painful touch of madness kicker. And then all of a sudden, it can suddenly mysteriously open out to something called equanimity. Now, since this is an embodiment conference, I'm going to get right to some of the body issues. So the body is going to be one of the primary things we're going to talk about in terms of self-care, in terms of grounding in the moment. But I want to give yet another disclaimer, and that's the trauma one. So as books like The Body Keeps the Score and Trauma-Sensitive Mindfulness will talk about, and I would recommend those if you have something of a trauma dissociation, depersonalization, derealization, et cetera, history. There are places in the body that for some people, when you go there, it can actually make things much worse. So this is an important thing because we're going to talk a lot about embodiment, but embodiment is not always the right strategy full on for everybody. Now, this since those are already relatively well covered in those resources I just mentioned, I'm not going to dwell on them extensively. But if you find that when going into your body, you're going, okay, wait a second, no, this is making me retract, this is making me freak out, this is making me scared, this is making me more triggered, then maybe you need to use some of that other tech. Okay, moving on. The next disclaimer I want to say is the limits of current knowledge. So while a lot of us get up here and pontificate about this stuff, and I'm going to say a whole lot of things, in all honesty, from a scientist point of view, the science of this is terrible. So we don't have a lot of great studies that really explain the best way to handle all of this. We don't have long-term clinical trials. We don't have comparative studies that say you do this versus do that, and you're likely to have a better outcome in this kind of person. We don't really know all of the predisposing factors with really good epidemiological data. We don't know any of that kind of stuff. And so all of us who are talking about this stuff are doing it from a mix of personal experience, our friends, our teachers, our resources, books, theory, and just seeing what happens as we do this. But it's all kind of at the brain hacking level at this moment, even as much as we think we kind of know what we're doing. So at the end of this, I'm going to talk about supporting some of the science that will hopefully help to fix some of that gap in knowledge. Okay, the next thing I'm going to talk about is on retreat versus off retreat. So a lot of people run into this stuff on like intensive meditation retreats. And some people would say this stuff only happens on intensive meditation retreats. I don't actually believe that's true because it happened to me as a kid with no formal meditation training. Some on retreat, hopefully you are with good teachers. Hopefully you're with people who know how to handle this stuff. Hopefully they are mature, skilled, experienced, have a lot of tricks up their sleeve, have a lot of good guidance to offer you. And hopefully they know what they're doing. If they don't, maybe they're not the best people to be doing intensive retreats with. I don't mean to be hypercritical. So a lot of what I'm going to talk about is assuming that you don't have access to expert guidance and you're kind of having to wing this on your own. Okay. The next thing is, if you don't have expert guidance or friends, I would highly consider acquiring them because there are whole communities that talk about this stuff online, virtually these days, in person for those who are feeling that's a safe option. And so those communities exist. It's not like 20, 30 years ago when I was going through this stuff and there wasn't a lot available. Now there's everything from the Spiritual Emergence Network to the Dharma Overground, a website I run where people talk about this kind of stuff, et cetera. There's lots of other sites. But I highly recommend social connection because one of the things about this, it can be embarrassing, it can be socially isolating, and that is probably the wrong way to go. Most people do better with some external support and normalization. Okay, next thing, and I apologize that this is kind of rapid fire. To do all this in an hour is patently ridiculous, but it's more fun than not doing it at all, and hopefully it will help some people and give you an idea of stuff to do. So the differential diagnosis for the Dark Knight. Important things to remember is not everything is the Dark Knight. Something might be just thyroid dysfunction or ordinary garden variety depression that really doesn't have much of a spiritual component, or anxiety, or some other crisis of your personal life, of your relationship, at your job. Maybe you really do need a change. Maybe you have things you need to deal with by ordinary means that have nothing to do with esoteric spiritual technology or any of the stuff I'm going to talk about. Maybe you just need to fix an ordinary problem or two and maybe get some help with those. So there are also, yeah, all kinds of medical conditions, and there are other difficult stages on the path. So there's a stage in the path before something called the arising and passing way that can involve a lot of like muscle tension, sort of tight anxiety, physical body pain. Very common if anybody's gone on a meditation retreat, usually between days 3 and 5, where all of a sudden your posture is tight and your jaw is sort of weird and you can't really sit straight and you're kind of moving and you feel like your muscles are kind of locking up and you think, oh, it's just because I've been sitting too much. Actually, that may be a stage called the three characteristics, which can also be challenging, but is not technically Dark Knight as I would think about, though some of this advice will apply to both. So even if you know, the diagnosis is ambiguous, some of this advice may still be helpful. Next thing I think is the most important thing to do is normalize this. So I think normalizing is literally half of the solution, that there's a thing called the Dark Knight or the knowledges of suffering or whatever. It can happen after peak experiences, which may be hard to identify, but usually pretty obvious. And it's a thing, and it can be challenging, and it can involve fear and grief and misery and, you know, wanting to change your job or career, disenchantment with daily life, a lack of interest in ordinary activities, a sudden fascination with spiritual stuff, and yet a kind of a weird reactive darkness in the face of that. Just know that that's something that happens to people. I've literally, over 27 years or whatever of doing this now, talked to thousands and thousands of people, read tens of thousands of posts of people talking about this. You're not alone. You're not the first person to have gone through this. It's not just a few rare monks in a cave or Carmelites in a monastery in the, you know, Middle Ages or whatever. This is actually a thing. The next thing I'm going to talk about is something called reality testing. And reality testing is actually way more simple than most of the tech I'm going to say. And I'm going to start off, I get a lot of like emails and stuff, particularly when people could travel, which obviously they can't so much now. But like the typical email would be some Trustafari kid, usually extremely healthy and very privileged in their early 20s, who is now on a beach in Thailand in paradise with extremely high levels of resource and good fortune, who is yet freaking out. And they went on a retreat, they crossed the A&P, they hit the Dark Knight, and now they are literally in paradise and literally safe and literally basically on top of the game of the world and cannot recognize that because the Dark Knight has managed to shut off their basic reality testing. So if you think, I might be Dark Knighting. Wait, I'm having a strangely hard time. Why in the world are those feelings coming up like this? This doesn't make any sense. Yesterday I was fine. Today I'm freaking out and everything's basically the same. Then are you safe? Like, are you okay? Is your current situation dangerous? Do you have enough food? Like, are you in an okay place? Or do you have physical health? This kind of ordinary normalizing and going can give just a little bit of space and skepticism and make you think, wait a second, maybe this is something Dark Knight-y. Okay, maybe I need to bring some of this tech to bear. That kind of reality testing, are you safe? And just asking that question like a bunch of times, maybe asking it once is not enough to kind of get it into the brain and go, look around. Are you okay? Sit on your bed. Sit on your couch. Am I fine? Okay, I'm fine. Maybe you are fine. If you're not fine, maybe there's some real world thing you actually have to take care of. If you are in a dangerous place or a dangerous relationship or something's all messed up, okay, take care of that. But you probably don't need Dark Knight technology to do that. Okay. The next important question is, do you stop and or modify practice? And a lot of people would say yes, and there's logic behind this. Of when you might just want to say, okay, I'm going to stop my practice. I'm going to stop doing this. I'm going to back off. I'm going to ground down. That often is a very reasonable move. Now, and sometimes people need to modify their practice either by not going into such a triggering body area, or by like going open-eyed and remembering the space so they don't sort of get so contracted into their inner world and inner darkness or something like that. And then other people are going to say, no, wait, you need to practice more. You need to practice better. You need to get your concentration stronger. And the problem is there is not a one-size-fits-all approach to this. And unfortunately, we can't just say, always do this or always do that. You actually kind of have to take an assessment. And you have to go, okay, what's balanced here and what's out of balance and what's doing okay and what's not doing okay? And I'm going to talk just briefly a little bit about a kind of basic seven factors of awakening Buddhist meditation theory here, which applies basically universally. It's pretty straightforward stuff. And on the one hand, you have, you know, positive sort of factors like mindfulness. Are you paying attention? Energy? Are you bringing like precision and a bright mindedness to the situation and investigation? Are you really like looking at what's going on moment to moment, the sensations in your body, trying to get some perspective on them? They come and go. You know, your thoughts come and go. These feelings come and go. All that usual meditation stuff can be very helpful for some people. Right. And other people, they've got way too much of that. They're like powering it. And they're just like winding up. Those people need to ground down. Whereas other people might be kind of like, yeah, I'm kind of dark nighting. It's just no fun. But they don't have like that spark, that brightness, that clarity, that investigation that can kind of have a little bit of skepticism. Say, wait, these are just little sensations in my body and mind. Can I take those apart? They don't have enough concentration. They're kind of wandering or contracting. They're not really being present to what's going on. And so they lose the capacity for that reality testing. And then you get some people who are forgetting the middle one, which gets missed a lot in these conversations, and that's something called rapture. And rapture in this case, I'm going to translate as an appreciation of sensuous beauty. So an appreciation that where we can tune into the positive quality of things, like most of your reality is probably fine. Like it's kind of cool seeing the light glinting off the camera lens I'm staring at. It's kind of funny watching my bat ears, you know, wiggle around the monitor or whatever. Like the simple joys of like water reflecting through a glass, or just the taste of cereal in the morning or whatever it is, just the sunlight, you know, reflecting off of something can be beautiful. And in the dark night, we can kind of lose touch with the sort of sensuous beauty of things. And so for some people, that can be a real anchor where you can start to look around and go, okay, is that maybe okay? Is that actually maybe kind of cool? And remembering something of that fascination and wonder that can often get lost in this can be extremely helpful. Next thing I'm going to talk about relates to the topic of concentration, because concentration for a lot of people, they think narrow. They think really pointy. This is good concentration. It's really tight. Except that in the dark night, for reasons that are kind of technical and I don't want to go into, often attention naturally would actually be kind of wide and complicated and around here and peripheral, which is not what most people think of when they think of concentration, except that's actually a more sophisticated form of concentration. So if you're a technical practitioner and you're thinking, okay, I want to be really concentrated, what you actually want is sort of something wide and open, and you want to recognize this weird thing of the center being out of phase. So one of the weird things about it, the dark night, from a technical meditation point of view, someone may have been like, oh my God, my attention was so clear. I could really see all these little particles and tingles and vibrations and energy. And it was amazing. And all of a sudden, wherever I look, I can't even really see anything. Things are kind of dark. If, you know, if you're doing a visualization practice, or like, wow, I feel like out of phase with things. Things are falling away. I can't find them. That's the phase characteristic of kind of technical dark nighty stuff. The periphery can start becoming clear, but most people are not used to the periphery sort of activating in that way. And if you have this definition of concentration that it must be one-pointed rather than kind of open and much more complicated with a center kind of out of phase, you're just going to fight and struggle with this thing. And that usually just doesn't go well. And eventually you get to that through exhaustion, not through skillful appreciation. So if you're a technical practitioner, it's just a little hip tip. Next thing, basic antidotes to hindrances. So there are a lot of hindrances, like standard, this is Buddhist meditation tech again, but like sloth, anger, desire, fear, doubt. These basic things can be arising in this time. And it turns out there's all kinds of useful information on how to deal with those. That kind of basic tech, I'm just going to refer you to a book called Mindfulness in Plain English by Bhante Gunaratana. He talks about all of the cool ways that, and just simple, straightforward stuff you can do to help with those. And I'm just going to leave it there, because otherwise this talk is going to be way too long and we're not going to have time for questions. then the next important question is it even important to go through the dark night? Like some people are like, oh, you have to go through the dark night. You have to face your demons. You have to face your darkness. And other people question, is that really necessary? Like, do you actually have to go through all that stuff? And this is an open debate. And what actually happens with people will kind of be one or the other. But clearly for some, they end up going there regardless of whether or not anybody thinks it's a good idea or not. And if you happen to be one of those people who's finding yourself in this territory for whatever reason, not to say it's absolutely critical or should be avoided like the plague, then the rest of this advice hopefully will apply to you. Okay, so the next thing is mental health. So mental health, my definition of it is basically entirely functional. Right? I don't actually care if you're seeing skulls, if you're relating to them in a way that doesn't mess up your life and interfere with love and work. You can feel your body rotting through the floor and react to that totally skillfully. Or some people feeling their body, say, rotting through the floor will go, ah, and freak out, even though it was just a bunch of sensations and their body wasn't actually rotting through the floor. So if you're having like a bad reaction to this stuff, first stop and think, do I actually need to react with that? To it that way. And if you don't have enough space and everything to ask that question, and you're just getting into really challenging territory, and you're starting to freak out about freaking out, and you're getting more reactive and getting more wound up, and you can't ground it down, even with all these techniques, you probably need to get some help from some professionals. And the problem is the limits of current knowledge. So if you go seek help from professionals, the problem is they're not going to understand most of the fancy Dharma terms and words and lists and stuff and concentration phase effects and all that stuff I'm talking about. That's just likely to confuse people. And they're going to think you're hyper-religious. So if you go into a mainstream psychiatric or psychological therapeutic setting, you're going to have to really scale your terminology down. And you're going to have to speak in relatively simple language. This actually can also be super helpful for partners, friends, family, a lot of fancy spiritual words and map theory and all that stuff usually just alienates the crap out of people unless they also happen to be an advanced technical map obsessed practitioner, which the vast majority obviously aren't. And so if you're talking with family, stuff that goes well is like, you know, I'm feeling kind of raw today and I'm really trying to ground down. But if you can, you know, give me a little space or understanding, maybe I just need to kind of talk about this and I'm going to do some things on my end to try to take care of this. But I apologize if I'm, you know, seem edgy today. That usually goes over way better than like, oh, I'm freaking out on the dark night. And if I can just get my phase, whatever, to, you know, some frequency of attention, that usually just doesn't go well. That should be obvious, but it turns out it's not always to everybody. The next thing is related to something called dark night bleed through. So dark night bleed through is the concept that basically there is a way through skillful speech and skillful action, even if we're having a hard time internally, to be sort of professional about our life. So in medicine, they train you, even if you're having a super hard day, to when you walk into a room, you greet people with a smile, you say, how can I help you? And you listen to them and you bring your A game to that. Make sure you try to bring something of that level of professionalism to your relationships, to your family members, to work, et cetera, even if internally you're having a hard time. That doesn't mean repress it and push it all down. You need people to talk with about this stuff. But there is something to be said about bringing some of those skill sets to your life such that you can get through this, hopefully with as much stuff intact as actually possible, which also reminds me, keep your wits about you. So it's very easy when getting lost in the spiritual path to think, oh, I'm going to go off on this and like this guru will this. And if I just, you know, get the right deity, blah, 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 and forget the ordinary stuff. So the ordinary stuff often matters. We're going to talk about that in just a little bit. And you wake up to your actual life. So if you're about awakening and really being present and embodying this moment, you're going to wake up here. So try not to wreck it because you're probably going to need it. So next thing I'm going to talk about is something really related to embodiment, which is called the PCC. So I was privileged enough to be invited up to get studied at Yale and then the Center for Mindfulness with Jon Kabat-Zinn Center associated with UMass by Drew Brewer and Willoughby Britton was part of the fMRI study. And what I got to see is there's something called the PCC. And the PCC is part of what's called the default mode network. And the default mode network is basically this, as far as I can tell, because I got to play around with this a lot with real-time feedback, if I would do something with my mind and it would tell me if my PCC was activated or deactivated using blood flow as a proxy for that, which seemed to actually correlate really well with experience, which was cool. And basically, if I was thinking a bunch of neurotic thoughts and the room was there and I was in the room and there were these wispy little things in the room, that's PCC deactivated, I was fine. And if I tuned out the room and thought little, you know, neurotic thoughts of fear or, you know, self-pity or whatever it was, then the PCC was activated, the default mode network was activated, and I was not in the room. I didn't have the reference points around me. And that was what seems to activate the default mode network. And the default mode network is what cuts us off from the groundedness of the spacious perspectives where we can see thoughts as just these little wispy things. Because if you actually do this experiment right now, like put yourself in the room, take the whole room as frame, your body, mind, and everything, and think a thought in the room without kind of having your eyes go up to the side and kind of tuning the room out, you will find that it's very hard to find thoughts, and they don't have nearly the trouble causing capacity that they would otherwise. And so by using basic neuroscience, which it turns out actually shows you can do this and you can learn to deactivate your PCC just by bringing your awareness to the room and holding that as frame, thinking thoughts in the room can make them a heck of a lot less challenging, even if they're really sort of usually triggering or frightening or scary. And there's actually research that shows this help people with schizophrenia and, you know, psychotic disorders. That's a whole nother topic. You know, lots of thoughts on that. But, you know, to actually have less trouble with their hallucinations and inner voices, et cetera. And it can really lend a proportionality to the fact that thoughts really are these teeny little things and not these huge things that can then, you know, when you make them huge and tune the room out, then the body can release all these complicated chemicals that get your emotions and sympathetic nervous system and all that stuff going. So anyway, and particularly with thoughts of past and future, which can be extremely troubling, it is good to be able to just notice, oh, that's a thought of past, thought of future, thought of a previous issue, thought of a fear, thought of just a moment. When you actually just hold like room, body, et cetera, really embodied as frame and think thoughts in the space. And that's a learnable skill that initially can be very challenging, but those are muscles in your brain you can learn to do well just like anything else. I'm gonna just very quickly name a really cool chapter in A Path with Heart, chapter 7, Naming the Demons, actually chapter 7 through 10, super helpful for this territory. I'm just gonna give that as a reference and not go over all of that material. But what I do want to talk about next is models of human perfection versus models that really include full range humanity. A lot of people on the spiritual path can feel extremely bad that they might be having a hard time or having defilements or, you know, thinking bad thoughts or, you know, that they aren't like perfect meditators and their concentration isn't all one pointed. And they've got all these models of how you're supposed to be on the spiritual path that can lead to a staggering amount of suffering, self-judgment, judgment of others, cutting yourself off from your humanity, denial, etc. Be super careful with all that stuff. And to recommend a book, I have, you know, my own book, chapter 37, really the whole of part 5 of Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha, which you can find for free online at www.mctb.org, really talks a lot of the problems with human models of perfection. Which brings me to the next topic, Vajrayana perspectives versus defilement perspectives. And there's this great debate in the, you know, between the Vajrayana and basically the rest of the traditions of, are these all skillful energies? The energy of anger is skillful if you can just sort of wake up to it. The anger of sadness is skillful. The energy of sadness is skillful if you can just wake up to it. And so the sort of concept of like less awakened versus more awakened energies, this is a super dangerous concept that can get a tremendous number of people in trouble, but it's not entirely without value because it does help to normalize and say, okay, I have a wrathful feeling today. I have an angry feeling today. I have a sad feeling today. I have grief feeling today. Where is the wisdom in that? Maybe there is some. Where is the compassion in that that wants things to be okay? And connecting with that sense of compassion that wants you to be fine, that wants you to be well, that wants others to be well, that wants justice to be done. Just actually doing that in the body as an exercise that you take, you know, minutes or hours to do consciously. Okay, where is the compassion in this feeling? And then figuring out not how to just sort of unbridledly run from it, which is the shadow side of Vajrayana, but to actually then do something skillful with it rather than just let it become crazy wisdom in the bad sense. In the same kind of way, resolutions can be super helpful in the dark night. It's a topic I'm not going to go into a lot, but just saying, hey, I need to be functional today. Hey, I need to take care of myself today. Hey, I need to just do these basic things, one task, put one foot in front of the other, just what I can do today to be okay and to get through this. And those kinds of resolutions actively stated can actually address parts of our brain that respond to that kind of stuff, as people who know who have done this kind of thing for, you know, self-help or whatever. There is some value there. It's not a cure-all, but it definitely can have a place in this. And then sometimes just discretion is the better part of valor. So I'm going to talk about oxytocin, you know, hanging out with dogs, hanging out with cats, oxytocin, watching funny cat videos, hanging out with friends, just watching a movie, skillful distractions. Some people, when they get into the dark night, they're like, oh my golly, I must solve my dark night problem, and it becomes this overwhelming thing that can actually become part of the problem. And if you can't, like, chill out, back off, have a sense of humor, put on a bat hat every now and then, you know, please, thank you, and just do ordinary self-care and chill out, those ordinary perspective, it sounds non-fancy and non-technical and kind of obvious, but a lot of people can forget that in the dark night. So just remind yourself, ordinary self-care, exercise, a good diet, getting enough sleep, like those things can be super valuable. Exercise has actually, you know, been shown to be as good or better than most of the SSRIs for depression, for example, another whole complicated topic. And then remembering childlike curiosity. So it's super easy for people to kind of forget, like, basic ordinary wonder, like the fascination that got them into spiritual practice in the first place. Like, what is so cool about exploring the mind and heart and getting this whole tour of yourself? And just remembering to, like, investigate ordinary, what I call core processes, like frustration with curiosity. What really is frustration? What really is angst and grief and rage? What are these things? Like, to turn it around and go, okay, wait, what is this? Because often we can get very reactive and projective, like, out into the world about the dark night. Oh, this teacher. Oh, it's this technique. Oh, it's this job. It's this partner. It's this whatever. It's this thing. It's this, it's me. You know, it's this past issue. It's this whatever. And don't just actually go, okay, what is right here? What is going on in this space that's making me run all over the place in this dark nighty kind of way? Right. And just, okay, well, oh, check that out. It was just this little tension through here that was really making me run all over the place. Wow. Oh, okay. Good to know. Another thing, be very careful with substances and other addictions, right? So the dark night is really funny. It's got these two kind of almost polar things it can do with substances addictions. For some people, like, they just go, ah, I'm just done with all that. I'm sick of all that. It can actually really help. And for other people, they're like, oh my God, I just cannot handle this. I need to relapse or whatever. And, you know, you just need to be, if you have a substance or addiction history, you need to be mindful of which of those is happening for you. And if you have a support network or other skillful ways you can help try to avoid those kinds of things, that this would be a good time to bring those skills to bear, which may be a lot of similar solutions to the stuff we just talked about, because there's obviously some crossover. Don't forget deep body healing work, like massage and all that kind of stuff. One thing I want to want to mention is celibacy and neuroticism. So these pesky Taoists have this idea that if you can just be totally celibate and kind of cut off that channel of ordinary human release and connection, et cetera, grounding down, doing something skillful with the energy, hopefully, then that will really help. Some people that just makes really neurotic. So just be careful with that one. The dark night, people can get really sort of narcissistic and kind of fixated on themselves also. So if you find yourself just, like, endlessly talking about you and your dark night problem, whatever, think about service, think about thinking about some other people. I don't mean, like, codependent service, like to some guru or to some unskillful abusive person or anything like that, but, like, just remembering other people are out there and thinking about helping them. Something in that can actually cause a shift in perspective, sort of broadens things out, like remembering space, remembering this consensus reality, whatever that means, and getting a little bit outside of one's own kind of narcissistic self-pity can really be helpful. And we all of us who have gone through that phase know that this is a thing. So if you find yourself being narcissistically self-pitying, okay, most of us have been there, who've gone through this territory long enough, but there is a way to kind of get out of it. And it often involves something about thinking about others. Speaking of remembering spacious perspectives, just remembering space, like walks in open spaces, remembering the space around you, beautiful views, staring up at the sky, that can actually flip one into the very kind of mind state that equanimity is like, which is open, expansive, spacious, flowing, kind of diffuse, and often undramatic. We can sometimes get a little bit addicted to the drama. And so if you find yourself doing that, just chill out, remember space, and actually do that as an active, open-eyed sort of practice. So techniques such as, like, Dzogchen and Mahamudra and some of those open-eyed just being here acceptance practices talked about in books like Shift into Freedom by Locke Kelly can be very, very helpful for some of this stuff. How are we doing on time? We're doing all right. I'll try to wrap this up pretty quickly. One thing I do want to talk about is grief. So as sort of insights and spiritual stuff kind of violate maybe our sense that we are the stable little thing in control, there are parts of ourselves that can grieve that. And some parts of ourselves may be very on board with, I'm going to expand out into cosmic consciousness and I'm going to become one with the universe or whatever. And other parts of itself, ourselves may be like, no way, wah, and go through like, you know, anger, bargaining, denial, grief and stuff about the loss of that sort of centralized, you know, fixated identity that in theory, the stuff is kind of dissolved, designed to dissolve or give some different perspective on or transform in some kind of way. Don't want to talk about all those models too much. But just recognize there may be parts of yourself, kind of like internal family systems talks about, or one of those kinds of therapeutic modalities can actually be very helpful for sort of talking to those, bringing those out, kind of asking their concerns and reassuring them. So that can actually be really helpful. Remember the cyclic nature of the path so that it might be highs, lows, round and round, back into highs, back into lows, open spaces, and around and around and around, that kind of thing. People who think this is just a linear journey up and up and up and up and up the mountain and then they're there. That's really not how this generally works for anybody I've actually ever met. And then I just want to give a list of resources. Cheetah House has some really cool videos and tech on this stuff, an interesting perspective on it. Trauma-Sensitive Mindfulness, A Path with Heart, The Spiritual Emergence Network, and the book Spiritual Emergency by the Grofs. There's the cool book out recently called Breaking Open, another one, The Stormy Search for the Self. A Trungpa book. He was obviously an example of crazy wisdom kind of gone haywire, but he wrote some good stuff. One of them is Transcending Madness, talks about the six realms. The other one, Journey Without Goal. Obviously, Pema Chodron's work is awesome. And then if you're interested in supporting the science of this stuff, so we have better than, expert opinion, and instead actually have really good science, go to the Emergent Phenomenology Research Consortium at TheEPRC, TheEPRC at .org. And hopefully you can help network with people who want to do the work that will actually make this better. Okay, that's my talk. Thank you. Questions?
Daniel, awesome. Drinking from the fire hose. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Rapid delivery. It gives us lots of time. There's already a handful of questions. I want to remind everybody, if you have a question, please write it to Daniel, short and to the point, at least as much as possible, so that we can get to all the questions. And not to put them in the chat, but rather in the Q&A, if possible. I know some people with iPad are. Just a quick question for you, Daniel. I have one. When I was training with Sayadaw Pandita, he always referenced this one in relationship to wisdom. So, for example, fear is one of the first experiences that come up in the dark night of the soul along the path of insight. And he would remind constantly that this is a function of wisdom. It's not the ordinary fear, like somebody's going to sneak in my room, or fear that my children are going to be, get out in the street, in front of a car. But he tied it to the path of wisdom. So how much wisdom would you say is in there, and when is it functional and when is it not functional?
Yeah, this is super complicated. So when you get into good old Theravadini theory, if we go back to where these maps come from and you read texts like the Vimuttimagga, they would talk about the danger and sensual attachments, the danger that you would be afraid of being sensual attachment, afraid of ignorance, afraid of the misperception of things is actually going to satisfy, which is a pretty dangerous thing in some Western contexts, right? So yes, there is wisdom and the detachment and the dispassion and all of that kind of stuff they talk about, that fear and misery and disgust with ordinary phenomena and ordinary experience at a deep wisdom level can cause that sort of detachment that allows you to then dissect and break these sensations into their component impersonal parts of just ordinary causal things happening without a self in them at all. And that point of view for a technical practitioner who has the sort of ego strength in the ordinary Freudian psychological sense to handle that kind of deconstruction and not take it too fast and not become neurotic about it or too hyper-renunciate or reactive in the face of it, then that kind of language can be super helpful. And I really appreciated that actually, because that really worked for me. I'm kind of an aversive type. But some people, that language can be really kind of toxic and painful for, and you just kind of have to figure out which you are, but know that that point of view is there, and it can be a very valuable one for the right person in the right stage of practice, but you have to be kind of careful with it.
So it's going back to what you said, it depends on the functional relationship to the experience.
Like if you're really freaking out and you are having a lot of ordinary fears in the stage, or paranoia, which I've seen, or like, that kind of stuff, which can also creep in, maybe you need some of the other tech. But if you're just like, I'm, treading my reality because it's all just impermanent particles of whatever, and you're doing well with that, okay, cool, rock it out. But that's that's a sort of a level of technical practice that a lot of people watching this probably, you know, that's cool high level stuff, but also it's a double-edged sword, if that makes sense.
So it depends on your, like you were saying, the guidance supports the people around you.
Absolutely. And hopefully a teacher can tailor that advice to you and kind of see where you are and give you advice that's going to help counterbalance. If you're way too attached to stuff, maybe dissolving it's kind of cool. And if you're like dissolving it is freaking you out and you're just becoming more unstable, maybe you need to like back off that kind of language.
Awesome. Awesome advice. Okay. Let's go to the questions. Amy Young says, how can I best support someone? In this case, it's her boyfriend. How can I best support someone who has lost both parents to COVID within the course of 8 days in August? So this would be an externally caused dark night.
Wow. Okay. So that's hard stuff. And wow. A, listening. B, there's a really look up the five stages of grief. And there's actually a lot of good resources on this stuff. The five stages of grief is Elizabeth Kubler-Rossi and tech can be extremely helpful. If hospice was involved, which they were, hopefully hospice workers and the whole hospice movement can be extremely helpful at finding local support, not only for the patients as they're going through this, but hopefully if you have good hospice-y resources close to you for family members who are dealing with this, because that's what hospice, at least in theory, is supposed to do, depending on their levels of funding and availability wherever you are. But those are the people who actually have like the most expertise in supporting this stuff. And that's super heavy. And I'm really sorry about that. And and you're probably going to need some people on the ground who actually have those grief supporting skills. And that would be my best advice, because those resources, they hopefully will have an abundance. That's their job and competence and core skill set. So I'm sorry. Oof. Good luck. And listening.
Yeah.
Providing space. That's one of the things you learn as doctors, like, providing advice often is not the best thing in these things, just providing a lot of space for people to have their emotions and go through their reactions as long as they're not harming anybody else. And to just be there as a listening voice and presence often is the thing that people need most. Me as a guy, we're particularly prone to trying to fix people and solve problems and stuff like that. We often get into trouble when asked to do these kinds of things. But I found we just actually lost somebody in my family as well. My stepson 2.5 months ago died mysteriously, maybe COVID related. And so, a lot of space, a lot of patience, long-term view and listening. So,
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, Daniel. So what is the relationship between externally caused dark nights that just happened to us, not based on our intention, and internally caused dark nights based on our process, the process that we're going through?
Right. So this is, while it's not always so perfectly clean to sort these out, I'm going to tell you the theory, recognizing that in practice, it's actually way more shades of gray. In theory, at least, you have ordinary life crisis, such as the death of a family member, right, which can itself be extremely challenging. Mm-hmm. Dark nighty stuff, in theory, is sort of a perceptual crisis of identity. It's the dissolution of the sense of a stable center point, knower, doer, controller, watcher, beer, at literally kind of a perceptual or existential level as a result of some sort of spiritual growth process that is actually literally changing the way you perceive the fundamental sensations and stuff and paradigms about the reality of you being a stable, separate, etc. Something. And so lots of different ways to language that. And then you get a lot of times there's actually both come together. So you have, ordinary dark nighty kind of stuff. You have sort of pure kind of, I'm going to say sort of more pure insight kind of stuff, as you were talking about, like on intensive retreat. And then, but a lot of people actually have issues that come up in the dark night as well. They have challenging family stuff or childhood stuff or job stuff or relationship stuff or money stuff or health stuff or whatever it is. And so then most of us being neurotic Westerners are dealing with both. And the problem is there is no perfect science for sorting out those, but I can definitely say that proceeding on both fronts usually works better than just assuming one of those fronts is going to help you. So not only pursuing sort of spiritual, meditative, techie, perspective-y, investigative, et cetera, embodied spirit, sort of spiritual, meditative, technical solutions, but also real-world problem-solving, therapy, bodywork, other healing modalities, etc. Connection with friends, solving real-world problems, figuring out how to actually face stuff. Sometimes the more extreme end, like if you're suicidal or homicidal or the real that stuff, like getting yourself to an emergency psychiatric care facility. Not that always goes well, but it's better than dying or somebody else dying. And so usually often we have both, and then sorting out that gray area, we really just need a ton more science on this, which is why the EPRC hopefully will help support some of the science of figuring this out, because all of us at this point are just spitballing it and giving you our best vague advice, which is not really based on seriously good data, which is what we would want from an epidemiological doctory clinical context, and we don't have that yet.
Great. So let's go back to the questions. Carrie Hellstrom asks, on a 10-day retreat, I came across a stark image of a giant figure buried in a dark, dank dungeon, emaciated, fingers gripped around bars, eyes wide, mouth open to a scream. I both felt it. I was watching this figure, and I was this figure. The emotion was sheer mortal terror. It was so profound, I immediately shut down and couldn't apply clarity, concentration, or equanimity at all. I can see and feel how this energy moves in ways in my life, past and present. I can be present with these tendrils, but I'm aware that there is a big, deep root tendril. It's just never come up again, and I sit or retreat. It's never come up again in a sit or retreat clearly. Should I seek this part in some way and in practice, or should I just allow it to arise when it does someday?
Wow. Okay. So getting into magical experiences, right? If you're having visions, realms, sense of you being some other entity or closely tied in with some other entity or energy, definitely, tendrils, all of that kind of stuff. So this is a huge topic that I would actually love to do a much longer talk on. So in terms of dealing with magic-y kind of stuff, I highly recommend a long series of talks I did on Monk on a Motorbike. So it's like 3.5-hour podcast that talks about dealing with magic, magical realms, defense, protection, like paradigms, ways to relate to this that are skillful, etc. And if you're functional, meaning this hasn't wrecked your life, in which case you need to get more help than that, then hopefully drawing on some of those various ways you can relate to magical phenomena will help, but it's way too huge a question, unfortunately. How many minutes do we have left? Not a whole lot, but I would just highly recommend that series of podcasts. And the thing is, not everybody is into having magical experiences or learning magical tech, but if you're having those, then there is something to be said for going into that realm, because they have, despite all the weirdness and crazy that you will run into in some of the magical literature, and exactly what is weird and crazy and what's actually helpful, people would debate. But there is a lot of tech there for how to skillfully deal with experiences of entities, realms, possession, body, consciousness, transposition, and all that kind of stuff. But just know that those resources are there. And again, check me out on Monk on a Motorbike. I talk a lot about this. And I've also got a talk coming out on some podcasts. I think the first one of three is just hit on liminal warmth. Chaotic thinking is another place where I talk a lot about that. I think we had like an almost 3-hour talk. So hopefully that will be a ton of resources, and that will point you in the direction of lots of other hopefully good resources.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay. So from Padraig, on behalf of that's, it's actually a question from Lawrence G. Asked, Daniel, in your opinion, is the dark night or the cycles of insight a dependent arising condition by a lens of fear and aversion? Is it an absence of metta?
That is a super good question. So what is the dark night? Is it part of a whole person tour that allows you to wake up to every single aspect of your existence? Is it a necessary sort of cathartic process where you by some sort of bizarre quirk of like divine, trial of a person or just biochemistry that you simply have to cross this territory? Is it a personal failing because you weren't doing enough meta practice? I would be very hesitant with any of those paradigms to be certain about. Is it true that meta practice can definitely help? Yes. So Brahmavihara practices, meta practices, loving kindness. There's a book called Loving Kindness, The Revolutionary Art of Happiness by Sharon Salzberg that I recommend for this kind of stuff. It's a great introduction. Is it true that meta can help a lot? But what I say that you're just going through the dark nighty fear-y kind of stuff because you didn't have enough meta, that's got a that would be too sort of certain, because we don't know all of the causes of the stuff. And also, I would be wary of something in the judgmentalism of that, because I know people who have done tons and tons of meta practice and are super loving people who, when the dark night hit, they had a hard time with parts of it. And so, yes, definitely helpful supportive tech, but I would be careful with the causality because we don't really understand all of it. And as the Buddha said, karma is too vast as to be entirely ponderable. So it's one of the four imponderables of things that are just too complicated for us to sort out all of the factors that create any situation or spiritual challenge, et cetera.
Great question. Daniel, I have my own question here. It's specifically about the progress of insight. And certainly in the Burmese Mahasi tradition, it is kind of implied that it is necessary. That there's no bypassing these stages. And if you want to gain equanimity and if you want to gain the path, these have to be processed. You have to go through there. You have to go through. And you had mentioned something before that some people actually seem to not experience the dark nights.
Yeah, so this is complicated. So I can tell you from my own experience, which is the thing I know sort of best internally, the fastest I ever went through the dark night maybe was an hour, hour and a half. And that was pretty fast. I was pretty good about going through cycles at that point. I had a lot of tech and support, a lot of meditative chops. But like so Bill Hamilton, who's one of the people who taught me, he said he breezed through one of them in literally 7 minutes. So that's pretty darn fast. I know people who have just kind of cruised through it and they just kind of felt a little mild unease and kind of were like a little, I'm kind of off today. And that was as bad as it was. And I know other people who've lost their furry little minds, right? And really kind of like, totally flipped out. And it's been super, super challenging. But most people, it's like sort of mid-moderate grade heavy life challenges, but not worse than plenty of other stuff people have gone through, you know, a divorce, losing a job, going to medical school. Kind of in that range, like, which is challenging, but not like, should never go there. It's too terrifying. So that's what most people end up having it like, right. I'd just say. And some people literally, it's just like this whispery little, whatever. So it was fine. And they just kind of cruise through it with tremendous
You're speaking about the first run. When people confront first time, there's no understanding. When there's no understanding of it, and let's say the self meets it, or you meet it the first time in your practice.
I know that's the other thing. You don't know when a cycle is going to be super easy or super tough or somewhere in between, right? So I know practitioners who pretty far down the path with a lot of technical competence, a lot of retreat history, a lot of tech, a lot of good, you know, map awareness, et cetera, who yet they hit one, you know, layer of their brain or whatever that just kicked their butt for a while. I mean, I get a lot of calls from people who are willing to be honest about this stuff and go, and who are some seriously impressive practitioners, you know, some people you've heard of, et cetera, who write books and whatever, and go, oh my golly, this is so hard. And then a few days later, like, oh, I'm in equanimity, I'm fine again. But that you don't know how a cycle's going to go. There's no predicting.
In the higher paths, the purification can be far more profound.
It varies, but there's a range, but there's no guarantee that it's just going to be either easy. You know, if it's easy in the early cycles, that doesn't mean the later ones will be easy. And if it's hard in the early cycles, that doesn't mean the later ones will be hard. It's much less predictable than that, unfortunately, in experience. And I've gotten to talk to, again, thousands of people about this stuff. So
beautiful. So let's go to Kai. She has a question. Does being in dark night experience matter to anything other than feeling okay? It seems fine to just watch what is going on with curiosity and interest, even if it doesn't feel good.
Yeah, so that's really the big trick. So like, a creepy sensation is in my body and it needn't cause any more trouble than that. And some people are really good at having that level of sort of objectivity. One just has to be careful that it's not sort of a shutdown denial, but plenty of people do fine. I mean, you know, people who cycle on the path all day long, you know, they go through these stages and they don't cause any other dysfunction. They're just like, kind of shifting perspectives, kind of glitching a little bit. There's like this, okay. And then poof, and then it lets up and you're good to go. So being able to just go, these are just sensations, assuming there's not some sort of dissociative or denial process that's going in. Again, the whole trauma thing, qualifier that I talked about earlier, assuming there's not some of that kind of stuff going on, then just being able to say these are just little sensations, they move through, they're wispy, they're no problem, is really good practice and highly recommended. So good.
Beautiful. Okay, so we have about four more minutes here. So let's get at least one or two more questions. Laura Soler says, can you clearly differentiate dark, nighty stuff from actual problems of reality when you're feeling depressed, sad, and grieving, etc.? And if so, does it help?
It can definitely help. So if there is an additional meditative tech solution that you can add to this that relates to specific phase problems, stages, be explanatory and normalizing and all that stuff, that can be super helpful. And so being able to identify this for some people is very helpful. They go, oh, right, I did have that big energetic thing 3 weeks ago, and I did have weird trembling and rapture, and I was super excited about practice, and all of a sudden, for no obvious reason, I just can't stand my job and, you know, want to go off on some retreat in Burma or whatever and wreck my finances or whatever it is. Then, you know, which, you know, so, yeah, exactly. Then, yeah, this is just desire for deliverance. Like, it's no more than that. Like, having that kind of like, you know, oh, yeah, duh, right? That can be super helpful for some people, and then apply some meditative tech solutions. Yes.
Beautiful. Let's squeeze in one more. Where did it go? So it's similar to what we were speaking about a couple of questions back. Paulina asks, is this dark night a recurring thing? Would it happen a lot of times during a person's lifetime?
Generally, yes. Oh God, people hate that. I mean, you know, sorry. Anyway, people don't like it when I say that. And nobody's like, oh, why should I do spiritual practice? I'm gonna cycle through this stuff. It generally gets way easier. It's not a promise, but it can show you things that it was really helpful to get some insight into. It can bring up shadow sides that provide tremendous healing. It can allow us to bring into the light with clarity and wisdom aspects of ourselves that really can be transformed. Those are all true. And yet it is true that the cyclic nature of the thing is real. Ups and downs, highs and lows, rounds and rounds and rounds of layers of mind of the stuff. But like a Sherpa training to climb a mountain and go up to, you know, adjusting to altitude, walking up to various base camps in the Himalayas, this is an analogy I've used before. You get to know the path, you get to know the stages, the slippery areas, the treacherous parts, the handholds that might give way, the what to do in a storm, if the weather suddenly turns on you and you can't get to shelter, you get to learn all this stuff and you get to become stronger and more competent. So, you know, over years and years of doing this, you know, me and most of my friends have learned how to really figure out how to navigate this stuff. And there is tech and skill and everything that can be learned, and it can be incredibly rewarding and valuable. So, you know, both are true.
Well, let's squeeze in one more. Because you're a fast talker. You had spoken about the five stages of grief, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross.
Yeah.
How helpful is it to relate these two maps, the dark nights,
super helpful.
The progress of insight and the five stages of grieving?
Super helpful.
Yeah, and in life, because, you know, death tends to keep coming back.
Yep.
And we have to go through this process again and again. There's no avoiding it.
And we grieve a lot of things along the way. You know, we gain a lot, but maybe we lose a lot. Yeah. And just acknowledging that and being able to have some very human, down-to-earth tech to relate to that can be extremely helpful. All right.
So regardless of everything in our being that really wants to avoid these experiences, they're coming or they're here.
Yeah, I mean, we were born into this mortal peril. We were born into this samsaric world, to use sort of Buddhist analogy for it. Death is a part of life. Change involves grief and resistance. And that's this world we were born into. And so learning how to roll with that and to be able to have some spaciousness and some clarity and some perspective and proportionality and tips and tricks for dealing with that can be extremely helpful. And these are learnable skills. Like all kinds of things. This is stuff that you can really bring into yourself and have become sort of a more natural part of your wiring, all the skill sets that help you do this. And it can help with a lot of other areas of life as well. And so a lot of these skills translate to other situations also and can be, you know, are worth taking the time to learn, because we are in this crazy, amazing mess of a world. And, it's challenging times. And so hopefully if you've got some time to learn some of the skill sets that can help you have some shock absorbers on the road, can be very beneficial. So yeah, thank you. for the opportunity
to. I'm going to make a couple announcements, and I'll give it back to you for your final word. If you have a tip, your top tip for embodiment or the Dark Knight, you can choose. To find more about Daniel Engram, I have already posted, Steve's also posted several links. His website is integrateddaniel.info. Also, the Emergent Phenomenology Research Consortium. The link is here. It's theeperc.org. And our next session, I believe, is with Ken Wilber. Is that right, Steve? It's going to be
We've got Ken Wilber up in 1 hour. We had Sharon Salzberg a few hours ago. We've got Jack Kornfield later tonight.
Oh my God.
It's a fucking awesome lineup.
It's an awesome lineup.
Cool.
And don't forget, the recording is up for 48 hours for free. Check out the library package. Definitely support the event. Massive resources to put this thing together, to bring amazing people like Daniel into your living room. Support the event by buying the package and invest in yourself. Daniel, any final words or tips?
Yeah, keep a sense of humor about this stuff if you possibly can. Remember your bat hat. Okay.
Thank you very much, Daniel Engram. Yay. What a great session. Oh, and by the way, everybody here, Daniel has agreed to join the Meditation and the Monk, Meditation and Science panel discussion. It's going to be on Saturday morning. For him anyways,
it's Sunday morning at 6 a.m. Central Time, which is 12 p.m. UK time or something like that. Go to the portal anyway, 25th.
We'll be with a scientist, a Swami, a Rinpoche, and a bad hat, apparently. Thank you, everybody. Have a great day.
Bye.
Thank you so much, Daniel.
Yeah, thanks, Daniel. That's awesome.